aren't any players there either, so you'll get a chance to level up, whiten your name, and waste no time. Then, I'll get back to you in a jiffy. The only thing we need to do is make an appointment, or, alternatively, arrange an appointment at the game forum. Chat functions don't work properly there. You mean you're not going to come along right now? Nope. Theory shook her head again. I have to accompany you to the capital. Well, aren't you a hard-headed woman? You don't get it. I have to. If they kill you, you're going to respawn right next to those oaks, and I won't have any time to get back there for sure. We're too far away, so we may never see each other again. As for the voice in the dream, it wasn't referring to the capital explicitly, was it? It just asked you to help me get to where I needed to be. Once I'm done with my business at the capital, I'm going right where I suggest sending you. So everything seems legit, and I don't see a reason why you would refuse. Then we'll head to the capital first, and wherever you intend to go later. How about the fact that you won't be able to enter the capital with a red name? I'll wait, somewhere near the gates. There are thousands of players going back and forth. I know a thing or two about staying unnoticed. Why don't you get it? I've already thought it through. There's no point for you to stick around. It can only make things worse. I know everything about dangerous locations. I've seen enough. Trust me. I won't be a burden. On the other hand... On the other hand, what? Duh. Nothing much. Might as well tell me. If you can make a portal to wherever you're headed, I could go there and make a bind point. If I had a teleport scroll, I could return right away, but I don't, so forget it. In that case, why don't you make a bind point somewhere in the Iron Hills? You'd respawn right near if something happened. Well, there are lots of people around. You cannot stay unnoticed while you choose your bind point. Those are the rules. I wasn't aware. Well, there's nothing much to it. The worst thing is that I have absolutely no mana after I respawn. Regeneration takes a while, and I can't go invisible while it regenerates. Should someone catch me during one of such moments, they'd be able to kill me over and over again. I'm completely useless immediately after respawning. Yeah, I've heard about players with red names losing all their stuff and a bunch of XP this way. Well, that's exactly what I'm talking about. Ross didn't plan on parting ways with Theory permanently. She could be trouble, but there was no guarantee some unidentified party wouldn't instantly replace her by someone like Macho Strongman or Nail in the Head. He'd have a lot more trouble with someone like those two, permanently grinning lummoxes for sure. He thought he should really hold on to Theory. At least, they had managed to establish a connection of some sort. Who could tell what would happen otherwise? So he'd have to splurge a little, nolens volens. He felt grateful for his tendency to hoard stuff, and also to Agithric's gang. They returned all his stuff without stealing anything. All right, Theory. You've talked me into it. Open your trading interface. Why should I? I'll give you a scroll for teleportation. We'll do exactly as you have suggested. Well, the scroll is expensive, and... I know you don't have that kind of money. Just take it already. I'm sick and tired of arguing. Okay, I will. Ross stepped aside from the girl and activated a portal leading to a spot near the mine in the Locked Lands where he had recently spent some time as a slave. He couldn't head back himself, or his mission would fail, but Theory wasn't involved in any way, so it shouldn't be a problem. He could do this most useful trick once daily, and completely free of charge, too. Ross wasn't planning on using this transportation method anytime soon, so he didn't lose anything. Theory entered the portal without saying a word. The portal did not initially react to her disappearance in any way. It kept glowing steadily for another 10 seconds, and then started flickering. Finally, it flashed and disappeared without a trace. Then, Theory reappeared. She looked around to check whether anything had changed over the minute or so that she'd been away, turned to Ross, and nodded. "I've made a bind point. In the very first place you could find? It was pretty cool. Lots of thorny bushes around. Players usually try to stay away from those. There are no players there, so far. The place is in the Locked Lands, near the barrier that had broken down. Even a large party of Imperial guards would find it hard to force their way there. I got through because they gave me a quest, and I didn't get all the way through. There were problems with mobs and the wild hordes. But that was already on the other side, in our lands, where the invasion's still going on. So, shall we get going?
All right, let's go."
This was the first time Ross had company, but it felt like he was moving on his own. Theory may have been accompanying him unseen, but her presence was not felt in any way. He would occasionally hurry up to make her move faster and betray her position in this way, but to no avail. Whether they were walking through the middle of a forest or sparse bushes where even a cat would be hard-pressed to find shelter, the girl stayed invisible. It would probably have been hard for her on open ground, but she was adamant about asking him to stay close to possible shelter, and Ross couldn't say no. Oddly enough, the terrain started out as empty as the sleepy Three River Valley he had just left behind. There were steep and low-sloped hills with rocks of all sizes scattered below, picturesque butts, clear creeks that had made shallow beds through the steeply sloped ravines, numerous creeks in orderly-looking valleys, sunny pine forests, and darker thickets of deciduous trees. There were raspberry bushes growing around the abundant clearings, and animal tracks good for walking. The place was the next best thing to paradise. One would often encounter herds of sheep-like creatures in the hills. They had horns, as well as bony plates protecting their head, and a thick hide covered in felted wool. As Ross approached a picturesque-looking rock, he managed to spot a striped tiger from a distance and made a careful detour around it. There were strange tracks aplenty all along the banks of the lakes and the creeks, and he managed to see those who had left them a couple of times, gigantic newts with their backs covered in soft spikes. There were moose and deer running through the pine copses. As for the small groves of deciduous trees, there was also the constant crackle of deadwood under someone's paws or hooves. You could find a bear in every raspberry bush, fat and gorging itself on its favorite berry treat. And someone must have made all these tracks and kept on using them after all. There were lots of animals of every sort, but no hunters for some reason. Either the location was too far away from the capital, and no one wanted to trek it all the way to this area, or game worth hunting wasn't abundant enough, despite one's hopes. The Iron Hills used to be a front line in the past. There were the ruins of a wall that resembled the Great Wall of China, and a large rampart parallel to it. They were connected by a myriad auxiliary fortifications, and the complex included dozens of fortresses and fortified settlements. Everything was old, abandoned, and in a bad condition. Obviously, those constructions weren't abandoned without a reason. Their condition was a result of some highly dramatic event described in one of the epic legends that the Second World was so famous for. The legend was naturally rife with fallen heroes, dark powers, and hideous curses no one had ever managed to lift. Now all these ruins suffered from the ill effects of that which had happened before. All kinds of the undead haunted them, while the approaches were abundant with scavengers eager to polish off the remains of all players fancying themselves strong enough to venture into areas as dangerous as this. In other words, there were lots of unpleasant creatures around the ruins. And what does an average player need when they wish to level up seriously? That's right, enough mobs that can be used for the purpose. Ideally, they need to be dispatched non-stop, one after another, or better still, in packs, by a group of players capable of using abilities targeting several opponents at once. That was where the players would normally gather. There were many representatives of the specialized light classes among them. That is, healers, buffers, and combinations of the two. Their own attacking abilities were pitiful. The ones they had were usually weak, and primarily aimed at the undead. So their options were either to level up in a balanced group, or hunt the creatures of darkness while avoiding every other kind of mob. Support characters usually had next to nothing in the way of defense, and such stats as perception were barely above zero. They did not have the capacity to give grief to any other players. In other words, they were the perfect quarry for even lower-level killers, and that exacerbated the crime rate in the Iron Hills ruins, which was already high enough. Having studied the forum, Ross picked a few places where the ancient fortification line was narrower than usual, but without any convenient passages that could be regularly used by players. The chance of running into something unpleasant was lower there, but it still wasn't completely safe. He'd have to trust his luck. Not the stat, which was beefed up beyond belief, but actual luck, which depended on anything but the sum of the character's stats. Player killers wouldn't care about his stats if they saw you couldn't defend yourself properly. Another sleep spell. Then he ran away to increase the gap between himself and his enemy so as to avoid an attack immediately after the spell would wear off. This was followed by a standard combination, a chaos arrow, followed by a good old fireball. Ha! He didn't have to run away after all. It seemed like the critter was done for anyway. You kill the scavenger Grappoid. XP received 17. Points left until the next level, 898,014. The battle wasn't all that hard. The mob may have looked scary, but it was of a much lower level than Ross, not to mention its stats, so it died quickly, and Ross only managed to receive a few measly XP points. Well, what else could one expect with this kind of a level gap, especially since Ross wasn't alone here? He had Theory with him. The strange archer was a great deal stronger, and that counted, even when she did not participate in the actual battle. The party's average level was the value that the game mechanics were based on in every calculation involving an encounter between the party members and the monster they destroyed. 17 points was the lowest Ross had ever gotten, and he was no regular noob. Given his impressive achievements, the progress bonus was very significant. Others might need months of leveling up, where Ross would manage in a week without breaking a sweat. He checked the bodies for loot automatically, without even thinking about it. Hey, well, at least there were some trophies. Talons, a beak, feathers of some sort, and an eggshell. So this beast was a bird, after all, even though it resembled a hybrid between a dinosaur and an unknown monster. There was an unusually even rock formation in the thicket in front of Ross, and he had strong suspicions that it did not come into existence in the natural way. He must have reached the very ruins where PKs had lots of fun, and the noobs they killed got a lot of grief. But there were noobs and noobs, and Ross had an unprecedented level of self-confidence. The things he used to fear about the game were getting farther and farther behind. He didn't even break out in cold sweat at the thought he might be identified at some point. This already happened a few times, but he'd always managed to avoid the gravest problems. He had also gotten a lot smarter since then, and knew where he could and could not go, which places were dangerous and which ones weren't. He was as experienced a noob as they came. Still, he looked around him. He didn't see anyone, but he had absolute certainty that Theory was following him and would provide support whenever he'd find himself overwhelmed. Therefore, he should keep moving. The area was pretty hostile, and he had no reason to linger. Those were the thoughts going through Ross's head as he took another step forward when an arrow flew right past his ear, disappearing in the shrubs, covered in clusters of small white flowers. Ross occasionally used the bow himself, and he had enough experience with archers to realize the arrow wasn't just lost in the bushes. It definitely hit something, and the sound didn't resemble wood or stone. The arrowhead pierced a soft body, covered by hard leather or a thin armor. You kill Junkie 3524. XP received 35. Points left until the next level, 897,979. The shrubs trembled for a moment. Then a tall, pointy-eared body fell out, dropping a nondescript bow that rolled across the rocky ground. The fact that the character was deceased was not merely announced by the system message. You could tell as much if you took a single look. The body was motionless, with the rear part of a long and thin arrow that had run through his head sticking out of the right eye. As for the character's name, the lettering was as red as an overripe tomato. Ross turned around and made an elaborate bow. Then he blew a kiss. However, Theory remained invisible. She was really good at it. Well, never mind. He was happy that she kept an eye on him. No one knew how strong the archer might have been, come to think of it. Ross didn't even expect that a potential killer could get this close to him, and his perception was leveled up all the way to 37. Even level 200 players rarely had such stats. So what could he do now? Well, searching the bodies for loot seemed like the first obvious thing to do. As for the second, you kill Bite04, XP received 42, points left until the next level, 897,937. You kill Archer 6341, XP received 29, points left until the next level, 897,908. Well now, it looked like a real cool party, and neither Ross nor Theory seemed to have been invited. He had to admit that the girl's tenacity was well-founded. It would have been tough for him otherwise. There were at least three adversaries hiding in the bushes next to the ruins, and Ross didn't even manage to spot one. In fact, he only got to see a single body. The others were somewhere in the thicket, so his only awareness of the dramatic events that took place came from system messages and the hiss of arrows shot. He instantly decided against checking the bodies for loot. No one knew whether or not he would get an arrow or a magical attack in one of the gentler parts of his anatomy once he bent down. Anyway, red names were unlikely to have any worthy loot. Their entire concept of gaming implied the risk of frequent death and inevitable property loss. It made no sense to splurge on expensive items only to have someone else pick them up. Their main opponents were helpless noobs, at any rate. Their level and stats would be much lower, and even if they were around your level, you could always choose a class particularly vulnerable to your attacks and ambush the other player. With such a strategy, even the most basic weapons and equipment would suffice, the stuff you wouldn't mind leaving behind in case of trouble. However, Ross still bent down and picked up the bow. He barely managed to rise when he heard a suspicious crackling in the bushes to his left. Someone was clearly trying to get through them and making a poor job of being circumspect about it. Either Theory missed someone, or it was a local mob. At any rate, the potential menace had to be taken seriously. Then Ross turned toward his invisible enemy and surrounded himself with a magical shield that could absorb some of the damage dealt to him, and prepared himself for using something out of his deadly arsenal at the first sign that they might attack. A player got out of the bushes. It was a light elf holding a long purple staff, followed by a girl of the same race and armed similarly. The elven maiden's appearance testified to the fact that someone utterly devoid of taste and artistic talents would do much better if they just chose one of the thousands of ready-made models. They would probably do better if they just chose to alter their hairstyle and the color of their eyes and their hair. Otherwise, you got monsters such as this one, with bright red fleshy lips in a permanent duck face expression, with a tiny button-shaped nose above them, looking suspiciously like what a plastic surgeon would do in a case of years-old syphilis, and a pair of manga eyes above. The overall effect resembled the head of a horribly mutilated dragonfly. Once the elves saw Ross, they didn't draw their bows or shower him with spells. Instead, they stared at the body at his feet. The girl squeaked in delight, unable to control herself.
"One down."
"You've done a good job there for sure," said the elf approvingly, mistakenly assuming Ross to be the victor in the recent fight. "Hey, he lost his bow too. Now is that cool or what?" Ross threw the weapon into the bushes as far as he could, explaining, "It's a primitive item that he must have made by himself, virtually worthless. Anyone can make something like that. All you need is to level up your carpenter skill to 2, or perhaps 1 will be enough." "It took him just 2 arrows to kill Tyke from this bow," said the elven maiden sadly, and then added, "The 3 of us used to level up together. It was pretty convenient. The skeletons barely managed to reach us." "Sure," the elf confirmed. "We're light elves, after all, so the undead can't do much against us." "The archers can, nevertheless," said Ross to sum things up. The couple started nodding at once, and the elven maiden acknowledged it dejectedly. "Archers are the worst in our case. We have no protection at all. They can kill us using the most primitive weapons." The body of the dead player disappeared, leaving another item behind, a ring that wasn't particularly shiny and looked like it was made of lead. Ross didn't even have to bend his back to realize as much, as well as the fact that the item in question wasn't worthy of being picked up by a self-respecting player. It was utter junk. However, the elf had a different opinion on the matter. "You're sure you don't want it?"
"Pretty sure.
Would you mind if I took it?"
"Sure. Go right ahead. I have no need for it."
"Are you on your own here?"
"Why are you asking?"
"Well, you know, you're a weird one. Your level is pretty low, and you hunt the likes of these." The elf pointed towards the place where the body had just disappeared into thin air. Ross shrugged. "I don't normally provoke anyone, but if they provoke me, well, you know, anything can happen.
These guys are from the Red Names clan. They keep hanging around these parts, and they seem to be having a field day right now. We should get out of here before more of them come over. They message each other when they run into trouble. Will you come along?"
"Where are you going?"
"We're always headed toward a quiet place, even though there might not be much to do over there." The elf pointed in the direction Ross had come from. They were clearly planning to head in different ways. Ross shook his head.
"Nope, that's where I've just come from. I need to go to the capital."
"You won't manage it right now. You'd have to come across the ruins, and there are lots of red-named players there right now. We've barely managed to get away, and they killed Tyke, the bastards. And they wouldn't give up. They kept chasing us and looking for us all over the thicket." Thanks for helping, but you better stay away. You're a low-level mage, and they have a shitload of archers. Might as well stick with us if you don't want to get killed. We'll just have to wait for an hour or two, tops. Then some real cool folks will arrive and send the Reds back to their respawn point. Then you can come out again and level up until the next raid.
What kind of real cool folks? Are you completely new here?
Well, yeah, something like that.
There are two real cool clans hunting here, the APK and the White Avengers. All they do is roam the ruins from dawn until dusk, chasing the Reds. They can gather in a jiffy if they have to, and they leave no stone unturned. Then it's quiet for a while. The Reds are afraid to come back. After all, they don't like to buy it either. So you'd really better join us. The likes of us have nothing to do there until the Reds are wiped out.
Right. So that's how it was. Ross was uncommonly good at getting into all sorts of adventures on a regular basis, and he must have just found another one, which could potentially send him to his respawn point a long way off in the Locked Lands, and he would have to retrace his steps all along. That was an unpleasant prospect, and he preferred not to consider it. Just an hour or two, was it? He would wait much longer to get to the capital at last.
All right, I'm in. It's more fun together anyway.
Exactly, the elf grinned happily. Should I just call you Bubble, or maybe Bubble?
Bubble will do just fine. I like the name anyway.
Hey, did I say anything against it? It's just rad. I'm Daddy Cool, and my girlfriend here is White Plague, but friends call us just Daddy and Plague. You can call us that, too. Let's get out of here before somebody else arrives. It's dangerous here, too. The Reds already know where the archer had been killed.
Morgan had no idea what to think. Worst of all, he didn't know how much he could report to his superiors and how much he could keep hushed up. And they would inevitably ask about it, and he would be held responsible. Second World Inc. was not just the game, even though it was the corporation's primary asset. However, there were also military contracts, training facilities, the sort of simulators that Michael Silber had worked on at the beginning of his career, medical programs of all sorts, scientific research, state-of-the-art systems for controlling complex machinery such as nanobots used for surgery, intelligent autopilot systems for all kinds of vehicles, and lots of other stuff. All of that relied on electronic components in one way or another. And Morgan was the corporation's most important and perfectly singular expert on electronics. He was the high priest of silicon crystals and the unworldly quantum flux of the electrons and the supreme lord of electrolytic capacitors and variable resistors. When strange stuff started to happen to the intellectual components of Second World servers, Morgan's subordinates were the very ones to be tasked with finding a solution. He had to admit that so far, the sum total of their results was zilch. Worse than that, they kept getting mired in a host of far-fetched hypotheses and ridiculous suggestions. Morgan more than earned his keep. He could just take a look at a device without even using any instruments, find the defective component just by pointing his finger at it, and then having it refurbished or recycled. He put great stock in the idea that all systems should function without a single glitch, always. He kept returning prototypes he deemed unworthy to contractors, with whole teams of developers going ape about it, but he would not relent until the result satisfied his needs. All the electronic components of the governing AIs were completely sound. They were tested most rigorously before they would get used, and controlled throughout the entire process. Right now, they were disassembled almost into molecules, with every nut and bolt accounted for. Yet the reason for the fatal error was never discovered. The error was of the kind that would make the executives climb walls just to plunge their teeth into Morgan's liver and those of his subordinates as well. One always needed to find a scapegoat, after all, and those responsible for the hardware were a prime target. However, the hardware part was not to blame. What had failed was only partially in Morgan's area of competence. So what could it be? That was a good question, and Morgan suspected that only a single person in the whole world could answer it. Aurelio Barbarossa liked to be referred to as a professor of psychology. That title was one of the reasons for his notoriety. It was received by a dubious institution that had hardly actually taught anyone, that constantly provided some news for the tabloids. However, neither Morgan nor any of the others cared one whit. Barbarossa was the man who had created the synthetic consciousness theory from scratch. It was one of those rarest spontaneous insights that only true geniuses are known for. So what if he was the only one who could fully understand it? The principles devised by Barbarossa were used in the production of artificial intelligence. Not the crude hack jobs known under that name since much earlier, but intelligences fully capable of abstract thought, which were perfectly similar to humans in some ways, yet retained all the most important features of machines. Barbarossa's AIs could not be made with a soldering iron and a bunch of Chinese microchips, even though they did need electronic housing, just like their predecessors, but they were much like humans in that respect. Very similar bodies could belong to a genius and a complete imbecile, respectively. Barbarossa never used to say they created AIs. His favorite phrase was, to raise a synthetic consciousness. He coddled them like babies. None of his creations resembled any of their predecessors, and they were impossible to copy unless one spoke of basic IT components, the substrate used for growing an intellect. The window of technological opportunity was very narrow. An extra inch in either direction would result in the creation of a stupid and incoherent artificial entity. Then you'd have to grab a large jar of lubricant and explain to your superiors just how you had managed to waste a lump sum with so many zeros in it. All the latest generation AIs were Barbarossa's creations, and there was but a handful of them. Some worked for Homeland Security. Others formed the governing elite of the Second World AIs, the top-tier group. It was also known as Mr. Ruckus to the airheads and clowns working in development. Others, too. The notorious system of threes, for example, when three lower-tier AIs are controlled by another from a higher tier, also linked to two of its neighbors, all of which were, in turn, controlled by an AI from an even higher tier. The developers made the hierarchy, but they got their basic communication principles from Barbarossa, as well as many other things. He was the only one who knew all the details of how this extremely convoluted network really functioned. The three highest-tier AIs were Barbarossa's masterpiece, the summit of his career. He didn't manage to produce any further models. He was the equivalent of a helicopter parent when he was growing those intelligences. Morgan had very vivid memories of the professor staying in his lab for weeks on end without taking a shower once. His diet was a subject of morbid speculation, too. Nothing and no one stood above those three in the Second World. They held all the reins in their digital hands. The fact that they hardly ever pulled them didn't mean a thing. It was just that the three governing AIs only got involved when the accursed balance was critically endangered, or when unforeseen factors resulted in scenarios where the basic rules of the game may be broken. Tonight, Morgan's team lost the last AI of the three. The electronic components were perfectly sound, just like in every other case. They could dismantle them until only the tiniest particles were left and find no serious defect. But without a synthetic consciousness, all the hardware was just so much junk that the tireless Chinese industry could produce in thousands of tons. A consciousness would have to be grown from scratch. The only one who'd managed to accomplish it so far was Professor Barbarossa, the oddball who disappeared 5 months ago, and there hasn't been a whiff of him since. He is said to have eloped with some hottie. His wife was supposed to have nagged him too much, but Morgan would sooner believe that the world was ruled by the hamsters his youngest son kept in his room. It was absolute BS. Artificial intelligence was Barbarossa's only passion. He could pontificate for hours, sending showers of spittle all around him, that it would never be exactly the same as human intelligence, pointing out the pros and cons of either. He could spend weeks among arrays of electronics, subsisting on stale food without so much as looking at the fresh Playboy centerfold that some joker had hung on the restroom door. Even that amazing babe with D-cups, who had always tried to lean against him whenever he'd be glued to the computer monitor, pointing out the critical intersections of variable lines in blocky transitions, Barbarossa's heart didn't skip a beat so much as once. The professor would never have just run away and leave his favorite toys unsupervised. Barbarossa was dead. He died 5 months ago, and Morgan had already buried him, no matter what everybody else said. Mentally, that is. Barbarossa didn't just disappear. What he took with him was a unique technology for creating state-of-the-art artificial intelligence. All they could do without him was copy some of the much inferior models blindly, and no one could make heads or tails of their settings anyway. So what about the more complex ones? The final creations of the professor's most extravagant life were impossible to recreate, even if one made a perfect copy. They were a batch of sentient synthetic entities, some of which were commissioned by the military, others worked for the corporation's research departments, and the rest of them governed the Second World. The three AIs heading the top-tier group were the most special of them all. They were Barbarossa's most brilliant progeny. There wasn't a fourth AI like them anywhere in the world. They had already lost two. Now it was time for the last one. All three had disappeared, leaving nothing but empty electronic shells behind. And Morgan could do nothing about it. Nor could he say what exactly could have happened. They didn't need a hardware expert here. They needed Barbarossa. And he wasn't coming back. One of the engineers handed him a short printout. "What's this?" asked Morgan, without really giving it a thought. "The log of the last system message sent to the operator. None of those on duty claimed to have received anything of the sort. Were they watching their monitors or snoring in unison? We'll find out at once." Morgan took a printout and read a few short lines. "Command canceled. Inevitable event. Launching the most recent sequence. Command canceled. Inevitable event. The cancellation has been canceled. Illegal command. Inevitable event. Interference reported. The rule 4.2.1 has been violated. Initialization imminent. Standing by for command. Inevitable event. Initializing. Command accepted. No signal. No signal. No signal. Emergency shutdown." "What could any of this possibly mean?" asked the technician. Then he added, "We have never seen such logs before, and what kind of rule would that be?" Morgan had a hunch he knew what rule that was. It was only a paragraph in the user agreement that every potential player was supposed to read, but most of them did nothing but throw a cursory glance at the first page. The top tier three AIs were lost. The second world kept on living its digital life, but all of it was mere inertia. Morgan knew that the observing AIs have already registered illegal behavior on the part of a number of characters. Things like that may have happened previously, but never on a mass scale. A project that had an unimaginable amount of funds pumped into it could implode any moment, and they had no idea why. On the other hand, they had their hunches. A hen without a head can run for a while, but that was no reason to get hopeful about its prospects. The hen that used to lay Second World's golden eggs has been decapitated. There would be no more golden eggs. Morgan wouldn't be surprised if this would lead to server shutdowns, player revolts, and the inevitable protracted litigation. So who would be named responsible? Who had lost the three main AIs? And who failed to find a replacement? Morgan, of course. This is why he would stay silent, doing everything in his power to prevent the worst-case scenario. There would be some losses, but he should stop the inevitable decline of the Second World by any means available. Once he had anything encouraging to report, he could face the directors, but not any earlier. Where should he begin? The rule in question seemed like a logical first choice. Morgan opened the user agreement, scrolled down to the game rule section, and found the paragraph he had sought. The project administration may not interfere in the gaming process in any way, neither generally, nor in regard to the gaming processes of individual players, nor in altering the game environment in any way. Nor may it get involved in manipulating data, allowing access to information unavailable to the other players, and restricting access to data considered to be in public domain. The Second World's gaming mechanics forbid any human meddling in the gaming process. No party involved in the project in any way, nor any third party, may access such functions. No employee may harm a player by their actions or their inaction. However, if a player believes someone disrupted the process with methods unrelated to the game, they can follow the usual procedure for filing a complaint, and it will be considered at first priority. So what could it mean? Why would the dying AI mention this rule, which had never been used? Barbarossa was sorely missed indeed. Chapter 10. Daddy and Plague kept showering the poor deer with bright sparks, using the standard entangling roots spell to keep it motionless. That was a rather cruel way of killing a mob, but the two of them were light elves and healers, so death wasn't something they specialized in. Ross decided to stay away from the battle, fearing that the amount of damage he could deal would come as some surprise. He'd prefer to avoid unnecessary exposure. He hadn't thrown all caution to the wind yet. Anything could happen in such a place. It offered nothing of the safety of big cities. The unfortunate animal succumbed, eventually, its hooves twitching in death throes. Daddy ran over, searched the carcass, and said smugly, "These have real cool meat, and I have upped my cooking a little. It's gonna be finger-lickin' good, Bubble. You'll see. Come on, it ain't far from here." The ruins that Ross barely managed to reach were left behind. They were now walking through a thick, deciduous forest, covered in low shrubs for the most part. The shrubs were impossible to see through, so invisible players like Theory reigned supreme in such areas. Any attempt to spot her was doomed from the start. They came to a sharp slope where deciduous were gradually replaced by pines, letting more light through. They barely started to descend when they reached the bottom of a shallow ravine with a delightful little lake, surrounded by low rocks on three sides and with a small creek babbling from the fourth.
"Neat, huh?" Plague asked him.
Ross nodded. "This sure is a lovely place. We had a few picnics here. It was pretty cool. It's always quiet. There's never anyone around. There's not much to do here." Daddy started to gather twigs for the fire. He pointed to the side. "There's a deep grotto there where you can sometimes find cave bears, way cool high-level furries. But those are the exclusive hunting grounds of a single clan. They don't ever let any strangers anywhere near. The loot it can drop is just way rad." A fire was a fire, no matter whether it was in virtual reality or not. It urged everyone to sit down around it. So the three players sat around the fire, watching pieces of venison sizzle on improvised skewers. "This is what the Japanese call shashlik," said Daddy pompously. Ross could have told him a lot about the difference between shashlik and yakitori, or whether the former could even be transcribed in Japanese, but he decided against it. They weren't friends, just temporary associates brought together by circumstance for a short while. They would part ways shortly after this short encounter and likely never see each other again, so being a smartass would only sour this brief moment of companionship. The roasted meat didn't look like much, and Daddy seemed like he wouldn't benefit much from that kind of trivia anyway. "Are you a pure mage-class bubble, or a mix of some sort?" Ross could be described in a variety of ways, and the description would take more than a single word in every case. However, he just nodded to avoid any further questioning. "Would you like to join us, so that we could level up together a bit?" Ross shook his head. "I have some pressing business in the capital. Gotta see a friend about something important. It sucks to be in a hurry when it's a long way. Me and Daddy kept on walking for 7 hours on end once, and I hated everything by the end of it." Daddy turned the meat over and said rather self-importantly, "Well, once we level up to 100, we can get some real cool riding pets, and we'll never have to walk again. Decent pets cost a lot. Well, we'll get what we can find, and then find something better once we make more money. Playing the way we do now, we'll never make any money. That's okay. Once we level up enough, the Reds will no longer be a problem, so we won't waste any time on them. And any group needs a cool healer. We'll find an assignment. No sweat. We'll go crazy before we level up as high as we need. I keep seeing those damn skeletons in my sleep, and I'm no longer scared of horror films. No one has a red name over their head there. Why do healers have to be so weak?" Ross pricked his ears, alarmed. He listened for a moment and then said with absolute conviction, "Someone's coming this way." "Who?" Daddy jumped up. "I don't know. But I hear them tear through the bushes back in the forest up the hill. There's a thick underbrush, and it's hard to cross." "I hear nothing." "But I do." "Let's beat it. Hurry. We don't have enough time," Plague all but cried out. "Let's hide behind the rock. They won't be able to see us from below, and it's easy enough to climb it from the other side." The ravine with the lake suddenly became a trap. The lower part was too well lit, and the other side was too steep. The players running through the woods would have all the time in the world to walk downhill and take a good look at you, or stuff you full of arrows. In general, Daddy's idea wasn't all that bad, but it had an enormous drawback. The position on the rock would leave them no escape. Not at any decent speed, anyway. On the other hand, the way up the rock was easy enough to find, but what options did they have? Ross shouldn't have stuck with this carefree couple for so long. A picnic with barbecue, they said. It would be fun, they said. There was barely enough space for three on top of the rock, so they lay side by side and kept worriedly listening to the noise, which was getting louder. A single player can walk almost noiselessly, even without leveling up agility or any of the other necessary stats. So there were 10 or 20 of them, and such a party is easy to spot from a distance. But these made noise enough for 50. They seemed to have been near the foot of the rock, but Ross didn't dare to peek out. When Plague tried to do it, Daddy stopped her immediately. He was absolutely right to. A player with high perception can see a mouse twitch its tail from 300 feet away. This seems like a nice place. Quiet and peaceful. No noobs should come here. We can sit it out and then come back when the APK bastards piss off. We could surprise the noobs. Imagine how pissed off they'll be. Hey, what's this? There's a fire burning here, y'all. Damn. Why did Daddy have to bother with that silly old deer in the first place? But no, he had a craving for meat and wanted to serve everyone a most exotic shashlik, a la Japonaise. Duh. Fires don't light themselves in the middle of the wood, and the strangers were well aware of that. Hey, who's there? Answer us! Doesn't seem like there's anyone here. Could some mob have started the fire? Melon, I've been slaughtering noobs in these parts for over 2 months now, and I've never seen mobs start any fires. Not in the hills, anyway. These mobs didn't just start a fire here. They're roasting meat on skewers like those damn Chinese. You're a right retard, Melon. It ain't the Chinese. Are you stupid or what? It's a Brazilian specialty. They call it shashlik. Some name, that is. Those geniuses must have gone to the same school as Daddy. Hey, you there, on the rocks. Do you think we can't see you? Come out. We won't hurt you. Yo, noobsters, speak up. Think it will be hard for us to climb up there? Ross was certain they could not be seen from below, but it was easy enough to realize that was the only place around that could offer any shelter at all. So they were goading them into becoming targets. Climb down already, you, or we'll start blasting the mountaintop with magic. Get to it, Matchstick. These noobs are too dumb to do what they're told. Don't! Plague jumped up, but Daddy managed to pull her back in the nick of time. An arrow whooshed over her head, and they heard a disappointed voice say, Damn! Missed her by an inch. Hey, Melon, let's drag her down. And you there, just wait up and think about what you're gonna do. If you come up with a way of pleasing us, we might let you go. Several voices started guffawing lewdly while a panicked Plague muttered, It's the Red Names, their clan, about 10 of them down there. We're really up the shit creek. Not cool, said Daddy dejectedly. An arrow hissed through the air. There was a short yelp, followed by someone shouting, On the left! There's an archer on the left! You kill Love to Puff 17. XP received 48. Points left until the next level, 897,860.
He didn't need any messages in his chat interface to see that Theory had already started culling the Red Names, but it was nice to receive another confirmation. Something hissed suddenly, and a strong flash lit up the tops of the sparse pines growing around the lake.
No! I see nothing! There's no one there! So Melon skewered his own melon to the tree all by himself? Are you a moron? Ah! Guys! Help! I'm telling you, he's on the left!
A hiss, then another. Ross had no idea how Theory managed to stay invisible in such an open area, but judging by the hell she had managed to raise, she was doing just great. The players with red names got skewered one after another. Some would only need a single arrow. Others would squeal in pain for a while, but a second or a third arrow would calm them down. Their enemies were likely wholly focused on their new problem right now, so the noobs behind the rock were likely of little interest to them for the time being. Therefore, Ross peeked out without fretting too much and assessed the disposition. Plague was wrong. There were around 15 reds and not 10. However, this number was being reduced at a very rapid rate. Three of them were already lying motionless. Judging by their clueless or right-out idiotic behavior, they didn't have long either. Yet they tried to resist, and they seemed to have estimated the direction where deadly theory had been hiding. Three mages hit a large area with their spells all at once. There was a thick cloud of smoke from the fallen pine needles, and blue flames flickered on the trunks of the pines. Another one of the reds launched something that resembled a lightning woven into a ball of yarn. It rolled chaotically, an otherworldly sphere of electricity, spreading sparks all across the area. A thin silhouette clad in a nondescript black attire appeared out of nowhere. As it did, another arrow shot forward, once again with perfect accuracy. Theory didn't immediately try to run away, even though she'd just been discovered. She activated some ability that gave her speed an enormous boost, and started running across the slope, making a detour around the lake, still releasing one arrow after another, right in motion. They may have failed to hit any vital spots or do any heavy damage, but there was so much shouting, one might have thought all the vendors at the market discovered the loss of their earnings at once. Daddy rose too, and asked, bewildered, "Who's this machine gun operator, man?" Ross didn't answer. He was watching the enemies closely, trying to estimate which one of them was the most dangerous. It would be whoever didn't try to hit the evasive target blindly, but tried to prepare something dangerous instead. Likely a control spell. That would be the only way of interrupting Theory's intrepid dash. And he did notice one. It was the very same mage who had previously thrown the ball of electric yarn. He did not try to hit Theory hastily, the way all the others did. Instead, he hid behind a pine tree and was making gestures with his hands before his nose, as though trying to roll a huge ball in his palms. He was obviously preparing to launch a spell it took a while to prepare. Such skills were usually the most dangerous, so Ross raised a short staff that had the very set of stats for such an encounter. The damage was low, but it gave a higher chance of hitting the quarry, even if its level was significantly higher than yours. A ball of greenish smoke appeared in the mage's hands. He grinned smugly, stepped out from behind the tree, and turned toward Theory. Then, instead of hitting her with something particularly unpleasant, he froze, a helpless statue. He could see and understand everything that was going on around him, but he could not move an inch. No player killer would have any expensive object on them, the kind that lowered the likelihood of a negative effect hitting home. Nor would they have any items reducing the duration of such effects. All of that cost money, and no one would spend it on something they'd be likely to lose. So he'd have to stand there for a while. Ross assumed he might come to just before the sleep effect wore off, or perhaps even not, and that he would be able to calm him down once again. But none of that happened. Ross didn't know just what spell the mage was preparing, but it certainly must have been one of those hand grenade effect abilities. Namely, it took a while to prepare, and then you primed it the way you'd pull a pin out of a hand grenade. Then you'd have a few seconds to launch it at the enemy, hurl it into the sky, or even dispel it altogether. But keeping it in one's hands definitely wasn't wise. It was the equivalent of playing with an explosive device IRL. The mage couldn't launch his ball of unpleasantness, nor could he dispel it. He couldn't even move his eyes, so he kept staring in a single direction. However, the sleep effect kept one's mental capacity intact, so he must have had a few insightful thoughts as he kept holding a magical grenade that would blow any moment in his hands.
A wave of green mist spread across the glade, covering half the players that had still been standing at once. They stopped hurling everything they could at Theory, freezing where the magical attack had hit them, and started coughing so loudly one could have expected to see lung fragments flying out from all that strain. But while Ross was busy with the mage, Theory got hit. Her ability must have raised her speed for a short time, and once it ran out, one of the archers got lucky. The girl was hiding behind the trees and trying to pull out the arrow that had run through her thigh. The remaining reds started to ascend the slope cautiously, forming a semicircle. They would encircle her and finish her off any moment now, and there was nothing